The BBC presents My Word. And here to introduce the program and the panel is Jack Longland.
My Word is a word game played by people whose business is words, and those taking part are Gillis Powell, Nancy Spain, Frank Muir, and Dennis Norton. Here's round one. Try and test their vocabularies. 2 marks if they get the meaning of the following words reasonably correctly. Beginning with Nancy Spain. Nancy, what is a romaunt? R-O-M-A-U-N-T.
It's a romance, yep. Jack, as in the Romaunt de la Rose.
Good, I'm glad you knew that, Nancy. I hoped you would.
I had it in the fifth form.
Yes, it's a romance, a tale of chivalry, a romantic tale. Chaucer's Romance of the Rose, which Nancy quoted, 2 marks. Frank Muir, the meaning of the word furbish.
Whom?
Furbish.
Furbish? It's rubbish with hair on it. Well, the verb, furbish, is to make as new.
Yes, that's good enough.
And to refurbish, presumably, is to do it all over again.
That's it. To remove the rust from, to burnish or give a new look to. 2 marks. Phyllis Powell, what is an animalcule? A-N-I-M-A-L, like animal, and then cule, C-U-L-E, on the end. Animalcule.
Whatever it is, it's a very small one.
Yes.
It's a very small animal.
How small?
Minuscule.
Yes.
Tiny.
All right, I think you have to have it. Yes, two marks. It's microscopic, which is the word I wanted. That sort of size. Dennis Norton, what is a tort? T-O-R-T.
A tort.
Yes.
It's in law.
As in a tort, a saw of... No, wait a minute. It's a wrong. It's French for wrong.
Yes,
anyway.
It is.
A wrong.
What kind of wrong?
Legal wrong.
Well, wait a minute. We've been doing a legal series. It's a wrong that you can get damages for.
Yeah.
That's all I'm interested in.
I think
in,
that's
Jack.
Good enough. It's a private or a civil wrong, from the French word meaning just wrong, rather less than a misdemeanor or a criminal offense. Well, now, before we go on to round two, I give each team a quotation for them to write down if they want. And I want the 2 women members of the team to study their quotations. At the end of the program, I ask them where the quotations come from. And Nancy Spain, with Dennis Norden, your quotation is, "Sweet are the uses of adversity." And Dennis Bauer, with Frank Muir, yours is, "The better part of valor is discretion." And then at the end of the program, I ask Dennis and Frank to give me their idea of how these words came to be spoken or written. And I don't want any of these answers yet. And so to round two. From the following descriptions, who was being referred to? 2 marks if you get it right. Nancy Spain. Their hair was entwined with serpents. Their hands were of brass. Their bodies covered with impenetrable scales. Their teeth were like a wild boar's tusks. And they turned to stone, all on whom they fixed their eyes.
The Gorgons, who were in this story about Perseus.
Yes.
And
sort of Queen Bee Gorgon was what?
The one with all the snakes in her hair.
Yes, do you remember her name?
Medusa.
That's right. Medusa was the chief Gorgon of this rather horrible tribe, and they were called Gorgons, and Nancy gets her 2 marks. Frank Muir, a charming, handsome, and unprincipled young gentleman of Seville delights in succumbing to the beautiful women he meets.
The barber?
Not beautiful enough.
It's a Spanish chap.
Yes.
Juan.
Yes, you're getting that.
Juan.
Yes.
Juan Meatball. Don Juan.
All right, fair
enough. Well-known chap. Well-known, susceptible chap.
Yes, Don Juan of Byron. 2 marks. Dennis Powell, the boy who wouldn't grow up.
I keep on getting this gentleman, Peter Pan.
I don't think he's a gentleman, but still, never mind.
Well, we won't go into that one.
Associated with pirates and redskins and all sorts of people. 2 marks, James Barry's Peter Pan. Dennis Norden, It would positively be a relief to me to dig him up and throw stones at him.
That's Shaw about Shakespeare.
Quite right. Well, now the next round. There are some French and Latin tags which are supposed to be in fairly ordinary use. I'm going to begin the tag. I want the member of the team concerned to finish it and then give its meaning. Two marks, you get both those. Nancy Spain, quod erat.
Quod erat demonstrandum.
Meaning?
Which was demonstrated. QED. You put it at the end of the geometry.
Well, it's not quite which was demonstrated, which was... It's the point from which you started.
Which was...
Clearly
which
shown.
Was must be demonstrated.
That's it.
Which was must be.
All right, two marks. Quod erat demonstrandum, which was the thing to be proved. It's what Euclid is always saying very tarsomely at the end of one of his theorems. Well, Frank Mel, yours is much harder, if only because of my pronunciation. Si jeunesse savoir, or if you prefer it, si jeunesse savait.
Si jeunesse savoir... And the fourth was D'Artagnan.
No musketeers here at all.
Si jeunesse savoir, if the young people knew...
Yes.
Si jeunesse savoir... Hang on a bit.
Shall I write it out in capitals?
Si vieilleuse pouvait...
You've got there. What about meaning?
Oh, what about that meaning there? If the young knew, if the old could.
It's all right. You creep home. Two marks. Si jeunesse savait, si vieillesse pouvait. If youth only knew, if age only could. A chap called Henri Etienne in something called Les Prémices. Two marks. Delespaul. O tempora.
O mores.
Yes. That's all right. Jolly good.
Old Miller's almanac.
That's right. Oh, times. Oh, customs.
And you're not very pleased about them?
Oh, no, terrible.
All right. Latin tag.
Oh, never mention them.
Oh, tempora, oh, mores. Oh, what times. Oh, what habits. Or what meaning, what nasty times and what beastly habits. Cicero, who didn't think much of his contemporaries, not an at that point. Two marks. Dennis Norden. Morituri.
Morituri.
If you like. You were brought up on the new pronunciation.
Wasn't the full one Ave something?
Yes.
Hail Emperor, morituri te salutant.
Yes, quite right. And who said
we
this?
We who are... said to I, Claudius.
Yes.
The gladiators. Gladiators said it.
Quite right. Morituri te salutant, those who are about to die, salute thee, and that was the salute of the gladiators as they came into the arena and before they started topping each other about in front of the emperor, who, as Dennis says, might well be I, Claudius. Well, the next round is about the origin or derivation of words and expressions which are in fairly common use. I want to know two things about them. First of all, what do they mean now? And second, how did they originate? And we begin with Nancy Spain, and your word, Nancy, is haversack.
Haversack?
Just like that.
Well, nowadays, Jack, it means, as distinct from a rucksack, or a another form of sack that you might have, like in dress.
Yeah.
It's one which is slung across from right to left and bangs about on the left hip.
And the rims.
It contains a goat and a musket and a bag of nails and all the things you need to be wrecked on a desert island with.
That's splendid, Nancy. That's a very good description.
And it comes from the Swiss.
Yes, it probably does. I think two, quite clearly, out of four. Haversack is usually a canvas bag, not always. Carried by means of a loop or strap going over the shoulder, and Nancy did hers admirably, as an ex-wren should have done, the right shoulder. You can not only carry goats, but your lunch or your sandwiches in it, if you like. But originally a bag for carrying oats, and havercakes for oaten cakes, and the haversack was what you put them in. And it comes from the German habersack, German harbour or harbour for oats, and the French borrowed it, as they did many other German words. 2 out of 4. Frank Muir, a decent chap.
It means a chap who's decent, you know.
All right, we'll take the meaning as read, but what's it come from, Frank? How
decent
does it originate?
Sort of chap. It's an old word, yeah?
Mm.
Not new.
No, not at all new.
Old. 16th, 17th century.
Earlier.
15th. There were chaps called Chapman.
Yes.
And chaps called Chapman kept chapbooks. That's where the word came from.
Yes.
Chapman was a trader, usually with a barrow or stall.
Yes, he was.
And a chapbook was an account book. And chaps who kept correct chapbooks of the Chapman were called decent chaps.
You're absolutely dead right. Four marks. It means a reliable sort of chap, and it is an abbreviation of the medieval word chapman, which is a merchantman or tradesman, and if he was known for his fair dealing, he was then said to be a good chapman, and he used to go round saying, if you want to buy, I'm your chapman, and that in time, because the English are lazy, got abbreviated to chap.
A decent fellow.
A decent chap. Well done, Frank. Dillis Powell, delirium. Delirium.
Well, it means being in a kind of feverish and excitable state.
Yes, at least that.
Usually feverish.
Yes. And but what happens to you, I mean?
What happens? Well,
your mind.
Oh, you talk a lot.
That doesn't necessarily describe it. I mean, there are a lot of people who talk.
You talk
without
kind of crackle, kind of, yes, kind of busy, kind of crazy.
All right, yes, that part.
Kind of crazy.
Now, do you know what it comes from?
Being too hot in bed.
What it comes from?
It's very difficult.
It's from the Latin.
Just from the Latin?
No.
Well, no. Valerie, I don't know.
It's from the Latin.
2 marks.
Why?
Shall we say 2.5?
2.5 from the Latin.
Knowing the origin. It's a disordered frame of mind with hallucinations and confusion and all sorts of things which are extremely embarrassing to your relatives. But it comes from a Latin word lira, which means the ridge left by the plough. And the verb delirare meant to make irregular ridges and to go off course. So that delirus was someone who couldn't plough a straight furrow, who went all over the field, and therefore was regarded as a pretty crazy sort of type. All right, on to Dennis Norden. Checkmate.
Well, that's chess. And it means when you put the other chap's king in check, and if he makes any move at all, he gets into check somewhere else.
Yes. And sort of figuratively, I mean...
Well, it means the same thing figuratively, you see.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you make any move, you're in trouble.
Yes, somebody else has done it, though, haven't they, Dennis? I mean, you don't do it yourself.
Somebody's done it to you, so that if you... don't quibble, Jack. My job's hard enough.
I was just trying to help.
It comes from chess.
That's it. All right. I think that's good now. 4 marks. To foil or outwit or outmaneuver somebody. In chess, accurately, I think, placing your pieces so that your opponent's king is unable to move without being captured, which is the object of the game. And it comes from the Arabic shamat, which means the king is dead. Finishes him off. And now we come to the last round and go back to the quotations I gave the two teams earlier on in the program. For 2 marks, Nancy Spain, can you give them the origin of your quotation, which was, sweet are the uses of adversity.
The toad, a lovely jewel, wears it in his head and so on.
Yes, not Toad Hall, Toad.
No. As You Like It.
Yes.
It's a long speech which goes on about sermons in stones and books in the running brooks and good in everything.
Yes.
The Duke said it.
Yes, he did. Mm. Duke Senior, the one who lived semi-permanently in rustication in the Forest of Arden.
A semi-detached arbour.
That's right. He's saying how nice it was to live in the forest rather than living in a palace. And sweet are the uses of adversity, which, like the toad, ugly and venomous, wears yet a precious jewel in his head. That's what Nancy quite rightly got. Shakespeare's As You Like It. Now, Dennis Powell, I want the origin of your quotation, which was, the better part of valour is discretion.
I was thought it was the other way around.
Yes, I know most people do, but it isn't.
Isn't it? It's in the heroic couplet.
No.
No?
Hmm. Same length.
Same length.
It's only half of one anyway.
Shakespeare.
Yes, Shakespeare too.
Shakespeare.
I think we give you one mark.
That's generous.
It's Henry IV, Part One, Falstaff. He's been pretending to be dead on the battlefield because it was safer to do that after he'd been attacked by the Douglas.
For 10 hours by Shrewsbury Clark or something.
He made a long speech saying that it was very, very expensive to have honour, and therefore it was much better to be discreet, and valour was a dangerous thing to have as well. Went on long, as you say. Shakespeare.
So shall I.
Well, now that's what we do, because I ask Dennis and Frank to give me their explanation of how these quotations came into being. And on this occasion, the marks go to whichever unlikely explanation receives the longer amount of applause from the audience here in the studio. So, back to Dennis Norden. Sweet are the uses of adversity.
Some time ago, a certain section of the public, a certain section, were worried because people weren't buying enough books. When I say a certain section, I mean booksellers. And they never knew why until a very startling theory was put forward at a meeting of the Book Publishers Association by a starving author called Morgan Hughes. Bear all these names in mind. They're all relevant, I hope. He said, I'll tell you why, Mrs. Hapling. He said, people don't mind buying books. They don't even mind reading books, some of them. What they don't like is keeping books. He said, what will solve our problem is if we can have disposable books. He said, I have invented paper you can eat. So the publisher said, are you suggesting that people should read something and then eat it? And Morgan Hughes said, why not? Spies have been doing it for years. They said, wait a minute, let's consider this. He said, my idea is, he said, that you read a book, and as you're reading it, the paper is such that it is pleasant to eat, but as you read a couple of pages, you tear them off and munch them while you're reading the next few pages. That way, when you're finished, you have no, what is called detritus, you have nothing left to hang around and take up space and need dusting. One publisher said, I think there's something in this, you know. I can see the trade advertisements now. Get the new Ian Fleming with the non-fattening center. Or, if she has a sweet tooth, buy her the new H. Trevor Roper. Or for tingle tongue taste, try the collected works of Matthew Arnold. They crowded round Morgan Hughes, the starving author, congratulating him. He said, there is one condition. He said, that the book I have written shall be the first to be published in this form. And he brought forth a manuscript of a slim volume which he'd called Insights. It was a book about the sites on which a lot of very famous inns have been built, you see. And they agreed to publish Insight as the first book. Well, now, I need tell you no more. The book is famous. It's already sold 1 million copies. In fact, he was presented with a gold dust jacket at a dinner of the PEN Club by the Dean of Book Critics, and Nancy Spain was what you might call the Nelly Dean. His book has gone into, been reprinted in about 38 different flavors. He's known as the sweet author, actually. And I think the final proof of his greatness is the fact that he has been offered the chancellorship of a very well-known university, which I'm not allowed to mention, but it's not very far from Oxford. In fact, that headline is the one on which I rest my case. Do you remember it?
Sweet Arthur Hughes is offered varsity.
I don't know about you, but I'm positively dribbling at the mouth to get back to my Oxford Dictionary of Quotations. And now we go on to Frank Muir, whose quotation was, "The better part of valor is discretion."
Something happened to me after the show last week. So strange. So weird. So bizarre. I'd arrived at the studio for this recording last Friday. It's a little early. And Valerie, who sits beside Jack and keeps the score, was having some food. It was BBC Rations. It's called BBC Rations Class 2, Desk for the Eating At. And Valerie was eating her food. I remember every particle. There was a pat of butter. There was a bridge roll, which is, as you know, a long, rather shapeless piece of half-cooked dough, tasting faintly of damp wallpaper. There was a slice of lettuce, roughly the age, texture and colour of an old pound note. There was a hard-boiled egg, and there was a small piece of cheese sweating slightly in a plastic mac. Valerie very kindly offered me her egg. It was one of those boiled, hard-boiled eggs only canteens have, which has between the white and the yolk a sort of black rim. I'd eaten a piece of this, and I was dipping it in the spill of salt which the BBC provides, and I knocked the salt onto the floor. Well, naturally, I tried to throw some salt over my left shoulder to scare away the devil, and I couldn't find the salt, because the ration, class 2, desks for the eating act, really doesn't give you much salt. Although I'd seen the salt spill over the edge of the desk, it didn't arrive anywhere. And search the carpet though I may, I couldn't find it, so I threw the boiled egg over my left shoulder, which, of course, is no good at all for devil scaring, and in fact bent a rather heavy microphone stand. But that was the first worrying thing, that I'd spilt this salt. Then when I got home, I went to bed, nothing happened that night. So the following morning, I had a bath, and before dressing, I weighed myself. Now, it's quite a good time to weigh yourself, because there are very few people in the chemist's shop. And you can... and on my way back, a thunderstorm developed, and I was struck by lightning. This, of course, at least I think that's what it must have been, because the air was very thundery, and as I grasped the back door knob, an electric tingle went right through my body. Well, of course, I had my wet feet on the gravel, and this is how these things work. Well, I might have known something's happened. I felt very strange and weird anyway. Then I got dressed, and I sat down to breakfast, and I sat on the morning paper. And when I got up, I discovered this curious phenomenon. I had somehow, by sitting on this paper, had influenced it in an X-ray capacity. And page 3 was shining through page 1. Naturally, I kept it apart from my wife. I didn't want to alarm her. So after breakfast, I ran into the drawing room, and my wife had a book out of the library. It was one of Graham Greene's. It was cabbage flavour, actually. And I carefully opened it, and I sat on this book, and I sat there for 5 minutes, and I got up and I looked, and page 3 was shining through page 1. And I realized that somehow something had happened to me. And like a conjurer's magic cabinet, I had a magic bottom. I could somehow... I could emit X-rays. I developed a sort of extrasensory botulism. And I only had to reside just temporarily on something, and I could X-ray it. I wondered how to put this gift to use. Chest X-rays, of course, or perhaps for a dentist. But then there's always the chance of being badly bitten. I couldn't go offer my services there. And then a terrible thing happened. I noticed that as the days went by this week, my powers were diminishing. my extrasensory botulism was waning. And yesterday, it had gone completely. This evening, I came in a little early, and I found Valerie sitting there, and I suddenly realized the explanation of my strange happening. It wasn't really any sort of emission of rays at all. I must have got something stuck to my trousers that made paper transparent. And then I realized that the previous Friday, while I was eating the boiled egg bit of Valerie's ration, I'd eaten it sitting on the corner of her desk. So not only had I sat on the desk, but I'd also sat on something else. Of course, I'd sat on the butter part of Valerie's desk ration.
Well, I didn't see that until about 10 seconds after the end, like you. But by your clapping, I think Frank Mill's story wins. And that brings us to a final score in which Dillis Power and Frank Muir win by half a mark from Nancy Spain and Dennis Norden. And it also brings to an end this edition of My Word.
In My Word, you heard Dillis Powell, Nancy Spain, Frank Muir, and Dennis Norden, introduced by Jack Longland. The program was devised by Tony Shryan and Edward J. Mason and presented by the BBC.